5:55 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. U.S. advice for Pakistan on terrorism. U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice met with civilian and military leaders in Islamabad Sunday, pushing them to do more to curb deadly raids that the Al-Qaeda-linked Haqqani network is staging in Afghanistan. Ayaz Ghul reports.
Ambassador Susan Rice visited Islamabad to discuss, among other things, terrorist and militant attacks in Afghanistan that are emanating from Pakistani soil. A senior U.S. official told reporters in Islamabad at the end of Rice's meetings that she called the Haqqani perpetrated violence absolutely unacceptable and said Washington also is very concerned about possible future attacks in Afghanistan. The official requesting anonymity went on to say that the U.S. National Security Advisor called for Pakistan to work toward reducing the Haqqani threat, and she discussed specific measures for working jointly to halt the attacks. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Health officials in Sierra Leone confirmed Sunday a new death from the Ebola virus less than a week after the last known Ebola patient was released from a hospital. Sierra Leone's chief medical officer said samples from the body of the 67-year-old victim, who died recently in a rural area near the Guinea border, tested positive for the deadly disease. Nigeria's military uncovered a major Boko Haram bomb-making factory and arrested several leading members of the militant group in recent weeks. According to a military spokesman, the operation resulted in the seizure of a vehicle and bomb materials. They included gas cylinders and fertilizer used in suicide attacks. This is VOA News. Islamic State severely damaged another ancient temple in the historic Syrian city of Palmyra. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, citing witnesses in Palmyra, said Sunday the militants used explosives against the almost 2,000-year-old temple of Bel. One eyewitness says only the wall remains. Iran's Revolutionary Court sentenced two people to 10 years in prison Sunday for spying, but did not identify the suspects or their nationalities. A court spokesman said the two spied for the United States and Israel. It is not known if one of those convicted is Iranian-American Washington Post newspaper reporter Jason Rezaian, who was arrested last year and whose trial on spy charges ended earlier this month. Another U.S. senator declared his support Sunday for the international accord to bar Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Democrat Jeff Merkley from the northwestern state of Oregon became the 31st senator to say he will vote in favor of the pact, which moves President Obama closer to a mathematical certainty that the deal will take effect. The U.S. Congress is set to vote on the pact in the middle of next month.
Anche nei giorni scorsi, numerosi migranti.
Pope Francis on Sunday decrying the deaths of 71 migrants in an abandoned truck in Austria, calling it an offense against the entire human family. Meanwhile, Hungary arrested a fifth suspect, a Bulgarian, on suspicion of human trafficking in connection with the deaths of the 71 migrants. Thousands of migrants continue to stream into Europe. Australian Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresta says the sentences handed down against him and two colleagues on Saturday were politically motivated. He said Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi should pardon the three journalists.
It is now up to President Sisi to do what he said he would do from the outset, and that is pardon us if we were ever convicted. This is a wrong. Everyone knows it is wrong. And so we will be using every legal, political, diplomatic, and social means at our disposal.
An Egyptian court found all three guilty of supporting the banned Muslim Brotherhood. It sentenced them to 3 years in prison. Gresta was deported by Egypt to Australia earlier this year. Election officials in Ukraine have canceled upcoming local polls in parts of two rebel-controlled regions near the Russian border, after determining that authorities cannot guarantee voter or polling place safety. The Central Election Commission says cancellations of the October 25th voting will affect 91 local councils in the rebel-held Donetsk region and 31 local councils in the nearby Luhansk region. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Monday, August 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir visits China today, Monday, despite ICC arrest warrant.
Right now, China and Sudan are having excellent relations. And this is how Sudan and President Bashir has been invited to China. And as you know, this is the second visit to China.
Professor Ibrahim Gandour, Sudan's foreign minister, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Herman Cohen, will discuss aspects of his new book, The Mind of the African Strong Man. Somalia bans female genital mutilation, and Sierra Leone confirms a new Ebola death, and could that hurt that country's countdown to being Ebola-free?
If she was the only one that became infected and we don't have any more infected patients, I mean, the counting continues from tomorrow up to 0.42 days again.
Dr. Brahima Kabo is Chief Medical Officer of Sierra Leone, and Kenya turns to agriculture for business to avert high unemployment. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's foreign minister says the International Criminal Court indictment of President Omar al-Bashir is merely a European accusation that has been rejected by the rest of the international community, including the African Union. Professor Ibrahim Gandour says this is why President al-Bashir continues to travel the world whenever he is invited by other heads of state without fear of being arrested. This comes as the Sudanese president begins a four-day visit to China today, Monday, at the invitation of the Chinese government to attend celebrations marking Japan's defeat in World War II. Foreign Minister Gandour says Sudan and China have good bilateral relations.
President Bashir is visiting China on an official invitation from His Excellency, the Chinese President, to participate in the celebration of the Chinese victory on the Japanese occupation. And the visit also will include talks between the two presidents on bilateral relations. It will also include meeting with Chinese businessmen who are investing in Sudan, and also other activities as well, including meeting with the Sudanese who are living in China.
How would you describe the relationship between your country and China?
Sudan is on the list of the top countries in Africa that are economically dealing with China. China has supported Sudan in very dark days when Sudan was let down by the U.S., including extracting Sudanese oil. China helped Sudan in the oil file and helped it on other economic issues. And this is why the political relations has improved with Sudan and China. Right now, China and Sudan are having excellent relations. And this is how Sudan and President Bashir has been invited to China. And as you know, this is the second visit to China.
Mr. Foreign Minister, are you not concerned, or is President Bashir not concerned, the fact that he's traveling even though there's an International Criminal Court indictment over his head?
We don't say that we are not concerned, but we say that this is a political decision. It has been faced with political confrontation from the AU, from the international community, from many countries, and it remains only a European decision. So this is why President Bashir is normally executing his duties as a state president whenever he is invited. We are backed up by the African Union, by all peace lovers in the world, by those who believe that this is a political decision because it's only targeting Africa.
Mr. Foreign Minister, last week a U.S. official was visiting your country. What's the relationship between your country and the United States?
When I was assistant to the president, I was invited to the U.S. I was there last February. And this is how we started our talks with the U.S. government. And 3 days ago, we had a long discussion in a two-day visit led by the special envoy of His Excellency President Obama, Ambassador Donald Bush, and a delegation from the State Department. And we had a very transparent dialogue. And we hope that we will go forward. The U.S. is an important country in the world. Sudan is an important country in the region. So we need to reach mutual understanding for the sake of peace and security in the region and for the sake of the people of the two countries as well.
Mr. Foreign Minister, let's talk about the just recently signed peace deal in your southern neighbor, South Sudan. What's the role of your country in making sure that this agreement holds up?
Sudan has got a moral obligation towards ensuring peace in South Sudan. We exerted a great role in bringing the two sides fighting in South Sudan, particularly SPLM in government and SPLM in opposition, to meet and sign the agreement, because we feel that South Sudan is heading towards chaos. And this is why we feel that this is the responsibility of Sudan to help our brothers and sisters in the South to reach peace.
Professor Ibrahim Gandour, Sudan's foreign minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Sierra Leone authorities say they are waiting for a second test result to determine whether a 67-year-old woman from the northern Cambia district might have actually died from Ebola. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Brahima Kabo says samples from the body of the victim tested positive for Ebola. Meanwhile, the government says it has deployed all of its contact tracing and surveillance teams and quarantined all possible persons who were in contact with the dead woman. Sierra Leone's last known Ebola patient was released from the hospital August 24th, triggering a 42-day countdown required for a country to be declared Ebola-free. Dr. Kabo says if the second test results are positive, then the country will have to start its 42-day countdown all over.
Of course, the last patient was discharged on the 24th of August. Then we actually started counting. And just until yesterday, we received almost like a distress call of this swab that was confirmed to be positive of this particular woman. But of course, there are a lot of theories as to how she became infected. Because one was that she visited one of the villages that had Ebola in Cambia about 2 weeks ago, a place called Kadalo. And at the same time, they thought probably she may have come into contact with some of the missing contacts who were not found in Cambia at that time. But mind you, Cambia had already gone 50 days without a positive case. So we are still baffled as to how she became infected. That is why the epidemiological teams are currently in Tonko Limba to ascertain how she became infected.
Dr. Kabo, could it be true that there are some people still in Sierra Leone who might have been infected but who did not tell authorities in terms of their whereabouts?
No, I think basically she may have into contact with a survivor. Of course, there is this feeling of the shock that is in one of the persistence of the virus in the body fluids of some of the survivors. So probably it may be one of the routes where she may have contacted the virus. But it is too early now to determine that, because the teams are now in the field trying to ask series of questions as to her mode of life. And see, we know there is no travel history. Either she came to Freetown or to Guinea or to Tonkonele.
So, Dr. Kabo, what does this do now to Sierra Leone's 21-day countdown to zero?
Well, usually you count when the last patient is discharged or the last patient died of Ebola. And we started counting on the 25th of August. And because she died of Ebola, we should start counting again day one as of tomorrow. If among the contacts, we are going to find out that people are infected, then we start all over again. But if she was the only one that became infected and we don't have any more infected persons, then the counting continues from tomorrow up to 0+42 days again.
Dr. Brahima Kabo is the Chief Medical Officer of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Today is Monday, August 31st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Herman Cohen has written a new book entitled The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures, in which he concludes that Africa's underdevelopment is the fault of its leaders. But some say Mr. Cohen wrongly assumed that African leaders are solely the cause of the continent's underdevelopment. The book is based on Ambassador Cohen's personal meetings and conversations with some of Africa's legendary and not so legendary leaders, from Nelson Mandela to Muammar Gaddafi to Samuel Doe of Liberia. Ambassador Cohen says he's more optimistic about Africa's prospects now that the continent is becoming a place for foreign investors.
I enjoyed meeting all of the African heads of state who were willing to talk to me. I think the most stimulating was President Senghor of Senegal. He was a real intellectual, very well educated. He was very French, I must say, took an interest in the whole world, liked the United States a lot. I also liked very much President Houphouet Boigny. He loved to talk about all of Africa. He was sort of the father figure for all of Africa. Generally, I tended to be more friendly with the French speakers, although I loved the English speakers as well. For example, President Babangida of Nigeria, I always considered to be a good friend of mine.
Well, you also said in the book that many of these leaders exemplified or personified paternalism on steroids. You talk about the patriarchal tradition in Africa. Based on the conversations, to what extent do you think this sense of paternalism has maybe slowed Africa's progress toward modernization?
I think it has, because the first African heads of state came on board, and the educational levels of their populations wasn't that great. You had a lot of illiteracy. Most of the people were working out in the rural areas on the farms, and they didn't have much sense of international affairs or national affairs. They knew just their local clan, their local chiefs. So the first heads of state said, well, these are my children. I have to take care of them. I have to treat them like children. So that didn't lend itself too much to economic development.
Along those lines, Ambassador Cohen, do you think it was just the fault of the African leaders, or were there some external connection?
I didn't see too much external, although I must say that, you know, when they came to power, they had to make some important decisions. They were the new heads of state. What sort of political system are we going to have? What sort of economic system are we going to have? Well, they took their advice on economics mainly from their friends in Europe, the French socialists and the British Labour Party. And these, you might call them left-wing people, told them nationalize everything. Buy up all of the main enterprises, the plantations, the banks, the insurance companies, anything manufacturing. Let it be government controlled, and then you'll move ahead fast. Well, they did that, and they were very good about it. They paid compensation, and the European owners went away with their money. But unfortunately, the method of managing these enterprises was not very profitable. They tended to bring on far more employees than they needed for political reasons, and the enterprises started losing money. So what happens when the enterprises lose money? They had to take money away from healthcare, from sanitation, from infrastructure, from education in order to pay for these enterprises. So things started to go downhill in the first 10 years of their management.
Ambassador Herman Cohen is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. You're speaking with Carol Castile and me on VOA's Press Conference USA. You can hear more of Ambassador Cohen's views about his book, The Might of the African Strongman, on this program in the days to come. For many years, Somali girls have been forced to undergo female genital mutilation, a brutal practice that has life-threatening side effects. However, and as Abdulaziz Bello reports from Mogadishu, those found practicing the act will face criminal charges under a new law.
Hope at last for girls in Somalia as the government signals its intentions to ban female genital mutilation, a brutal practice girls in Somalia have been forced to undergo for years. The practice is very popular in many African and Middle East countries. According to figures by the United Nations Children's Fund, female genital mutilation in Somalia alone stands at 98%. Among its effects are lifelong pain, infections, infertility, and difficulties during childbirth.
In the past, when girls were subjected to FGM, it used to be something the society was proud of. But it's no longer the same. People shy from being associated with FGM. Now, when parents want their daughters to undergo FGM, they opt for underground avenues rather than public. That's a clear indication that the number of cases has drastically reduced.
Now, the government is creating a clear policy that will end the practice. Religious leaders, community heads, and the country's lawmakers are considering legislation initiated by the Ministry of Women. Once the law comes into use, Those found practicing the act will be arrested.
To all those who practice FGM, we have seen the effect it has. This practice has to come to an end. The ministry is also working on establishing a law to ban FGM. If anyone will be found practicing this culture, they will be arrested by the government.
Experts say a community mobilization effort will help end the practice and raise awareness of the law in a country where the practice of female genital mutilation is almost universal. The practice has been outlawed in 18 other African countries. Experts say eradicating the brutal practice in Somalia will take time, but banning it is a major step to ensuring that Somali girls will have a normal life in the future. Abdulaziz Bilo for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi says his country will benefit immensely if Zimbabwean farmers are allowed to buy land for commercial purposes. President Nyusi, who officially opened Zimbabwe's agricultural show in Harare last Friday, was quoted by the state-controlled Herald newspaper as saying this will also deepen Zimbabwe-Mozambique relations. But some agriculturists, like Roger Mpande, said the agricultural show has lost its touch due to the current harsh socio-economic situation in Zimbabwe.
Generally, an agricultural show is held under the auspices that you have all stakeholders involved. Stakeholders, the value chain stakeholders, agricultural producers, the equipment, input suppliers, trade links within the country, outside the country. So it's that unison that you are supposed to see among stakeholders, which is then supposed to create the final product that you are looking at. It is the linkages that we are supposed to have. Now, if those linkages are not in existence, it is very difficult to have a product that we want. So I find it difficult for us to then improve on our agricultural trade production and many other processes if we don't have the stakeholders linked up in full unison.
Now, looking at what is happening in Zimbabwe, can you safely say maybe this is a waste of time? And if it is a waste of time, what can you advise those that are organizing such events?
It is difficult for me to advise the agricultural show organizers, but it's best for me to go back to the policymakers themselves, who are supposed to then turn around the whole economic situation, mainly in the agricultural system, so that the agricultural shows make sense.
That was Zimbabwe agriculturist Roger Mpande speaking from Harare with Gip Dube of VOA's Zimbabwe service. Each year, Kenyan universities put out graduates for the job market despite the country's high rate of youth unemployment. Now, some of these young men and women have realized that agriculture can be as rewarding as any other business or job and are resorting to agribusiness in large numbers as a way of tackling unemployment. Rayel Ombuo reports.
This is one of Caleb's four farmlands that he leased to practice agribusiness 3 years ago. He grows vegetables and keeps poultry and dairy cows. The 33-year-old says many youth are venturing into agribusiness, which does not require a lot of capital to start.
Many times people think that you need a lot of money to get into agribusiness. With $100, you're good to lease some land. Really, in Kenya, in a part of this country, 1 acre, you're good to go.
Increasing numbers of young people are taking up farming, and the sector is growing. Diana Kuya, a diplomacy student at the University of Nairobi, has identified some land that is for lease and plans to start pursuing agribusiness once she is done with her studies.
Knowledge is important, but it's not everything, you know? You have to be wise. You would wait for that white-collar job so that you start getting your own money, so that you become independent and all that stuff. And an amazing thing about agriculture is that you can start it at whatever age.
Jacob Neitu, an economist, agrees. He says this is one of the reasons why the government is pumping billions into the sector, with an aim of pushing agriculture from subsistence to business.
People are no longer seeing agriculture as a way for those who cannot make it, but instead it's becoming a sector which can attract each and every one of us, so it can solve the very big unemployment problem that we are currently facing.
Agricultural experts say there has been a change of attitude and a realization that the agricultural sector can be rewarding if done right. However, they say people new to farming, like student Diana Kuya, will need mentors to guide them as they try to create something for themselves and others in the future. Rael Umbur for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Awoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. Almaz Ayana clocked 14 minutes and 26.83 seconds to lead Senbere Teferi and Genzebe Dibaba in an unprecedented 1-2-3 Ethiopian medal podium sweep in women's 5,000 meters on Sunday. The day started on a positive note for the Ethiopians as Mare Dibaba won women's marathon. Kenyan Hela Kiprop was second. Defending champions Ashbel Kiprop and Elijah Manangoi clinched a 1-2 Kenyan triumph in men's 1,500 meters as third-placed Abdelati Igida secured Morocco's only medal of the championship, while South African Sunet Fulyun clinched a bronze medal in women's javelin. Early on Saturday, Caleb Mwangangi Ndiku was runner-up in 5,000 meters as Ethiopian Hagos Gebrehiwet was third. Kenyan defending champion Eunice Jepkoech-Sum relinquished her title when she placed third in women's 800 meters. Algerian Larbi Bourada amassed 8,461 points in the decathlon. Though he was placed fifth, Bourada set a new Africa decathlon record. He erases the previous mark of 8,398 points by South Africa's Willem Kutsen in May. Meanwhile, Africans had mixed fortunes in 4x400-meter relay. The quartet of Onkabetse Nkobolo, Nigel Amos, Liamane Matotonganong, and Isaac Makwala set a Botswana men's record of 2 minutes and 59.95 seconds in their heat. However, this was not sufficient to qualify for the finals. On the other hand, a Nigeria women's quartet of Regina George Funke Adeloye, Oluwatosin Adeloye, and Patience Okon won their heat in 3 minutes and 23.27 seconds, but went on to finish fifth in the finals. Still in Beijing, Kenya are the first Africans to top the medal table ever since the World Athletics Championships began in Helsinki, Finland in 1983. At the conclusion of the championships on Sunday, they had amassed 7 gold, 6 silver, and 3 bronze medals. Jamaica is second, followed by the United States of America, then Britain. Ethiopia is fifth with 3 gold, 3 silver, and 2 bronze medals. South Africa is 13th with 1 gold and 2 bronze medals. Eritrea is 15th with 1 gold medal. Egypt and Tunisia share 25th place with a silver medal each, while Morocco and Uganda are jointly 32nd with a bronze medal apiece among 43 countries on the final medal table. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, August 31st.
Dear BOA, permit me to congratulate President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria and my dear state governor, distinguished Senator Professor Ben Ayade, for their 100 days in office. May God continue to grant them the foresight so as to enable them justify the confidence of their electorates. I am Prince John Ushie from Bendi, in Obanoku, Obudu, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. That's it for this Monday, August 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good and productive week.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S.-African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA joint conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk. Wife earning more money than her husband. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing this sensitive issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.